Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Hello, I'm Andrew McDermott. Glad to have you with us. Today, I'm joined again by biochemist Michael Behe, professor of biological sciences at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. And he's also senior fellow at Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Behe is author of Darwin's Black Box, named one of the 100 most important books of the 20th century by National Review and World Magazine, and of the follow-up The Edge of Evolution. Behe has presented his work at major universities throughout North America and the United Kingdom. Michael, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Andrew. It's great to be back with you.
So you've got a new book published by Harper One called Darwin Devolves, the new science about DNA that challenges evolution. And before the book even came out, Science, one of the world's top science journals, published a three-author, preemptive, pre-publication review of Darwin Devolves. The review is titled, A Biochemist's Crusade to Overturn Evolution Misrepresents Theory and Ignores Evidence. In one of your responses to the review, you say you're ecstatic about it, calling it embarrassingly, cringe-inducingly weak. In a previous episode, you told us why you're so happy with it, namely that they offered no response to the central argument of your book. And then you broke down for us three counterexamples the authors present in their review: exaptation, gene duplication, and guided laboratory evolution, showing why each of those fails to refute the arguments you make in your book. You continue your thorough response to the Science Journal review by listing no less than four instances where the reviewers recycle old hand-waving critiques of your earlier books that were either grossly inadequate or irrelevant, or both, even when they were first published. So, with our time today, I was hoping we could review the stale arguments that they bring up in their review of your book, and you can clarify again that you've answered these old arguments of your work already, and that your arguments still stand today, despite the claim that they've been, quote, dismantled, unquote. First, a quick review for those who haven't listened to part one of our conversation yet. Why the ecstasy over this review?
Well, whenever you propose an idea that's counter to the prevailing experts in the field, you're nervous that once it comes out, that it will be shut down. But in fact, the book proposes a very new idea, and the reviewers, as I mentioned before, had absolutely nothing to counter that idea. They didn't even talk about the idea. They talked about extraneous stuff like, you know, court rulings and whether or not my colleagues like this. So I was pleased they had absolutely no response to the substance of the book, and that makes you feel that maybe you're onto something here.
Sure. Well, briefly, what's the premise of your new book, Darwin Devolves?
Well, it's this, that evolution takes place at the molecular level. Darwin didn't know about molecules or cells, but we've learned that, in fact, the basis of life is the cell, and it's run by molecular machines, and that mutations, the fuel of evolution, are changes in molecules, in DNA and proteins. But it wasn't until very recently, the past 10, maybe 20 years, that science has developed the easy ability to look for what changes might happen in the DNA of organisms when they have a mutation that is beneficial. And we've been surprised to see that, in fact, the great majority of mutations that are beneficial are ones that degrade or even destroy pre-existing genes. That is, they're throwing away stuff that was already there. And that cannot account for the building of the sophisticated machinery of the cell in the first place.
Well, we'll explore more of that as we go along, but you've told us what they didn't say in this review. Let's see what they did say. In the first instance of a stale argument that they brought up, the review's authors, Richard Lenski, Joshua Swamidas, and Nathan Lentz, fault you for not discussing an article Kenneth Miller published in the very book in which you answered his objections with your own article. Did I get that right? What do you make of that?
Yes, it was very peculiar. One of the big points they make in the review is why this Behe fellow just ignores all the corrections that the scientific community has presented to him. And as an instance of this, they say, well, look at this article Kenneth Miller, a professor of biology at Brown University, wrote proposing a model for blood clotting. And they pointed to an article of his which didn't even address blood clotting and which occurred in a scholarly book which was an anthology of arguments for and against design. And in that anthology, I too had a chapter, and it addressed objections to blood clotting and irreducible complexity and other points that were made in Darwin's Black Box. So I was responding to critics in the very same book that they cite an article about claiming that I don't respond to critics. It's really embarrassing. Well, that's why I said the review is embarrassing. And I think it's just that many Darwinists, including the authors of the review, are just so confident of their theory, and everybody they talk to agrees with them, that they just can't conceive that there would be, you know, rebuttals to what they think of as compelling criticisms of my own argument, and which I think are pretty weak. But in their eyes, they think they look great. And so they don't really even have to go and see if I've responded to them, because they're unanswerable in their view. So it's really it's not a good review.
Well, it sounds like they're not doing their homework. And if it was just one instance, maybe we could forgive them. But then there's more, as you recount. Next, the reviewers say you failed to take into account work by biochemist Russell Doolittle supporting an evolutionary explanation for the blood clotting cascade. Where did they go wrong with that one?
Well, it's really hard to see where they went wrong here, because I discussed Russell Doolittle's work on the blood clotting cascade in the appendix of Darwin Devolves. And I showed why, in fact, his work does not comprise an answer to my questions. I don't understand how they missed that. I point out in the appendix that Doolittle is a distinguished scientist. He's retired now. He was a professor of biochemistry at the University of California, San Diego, a member of the National Academy of Sciences, and had worked nearly his whole career, more than 50 years, on the blood clotting cascade. And he's done great work, but most of it relevant to evolution is simply to compare the protein amino acid sequences of blood clotting factors in one organism and compare them to a different class of organisms and to compare them internally with each other. And that's interesting work, and it might show if the proteins are related to each other, but it does not show how they might have arisen, or how the cascade could have arisen, or even after it had arisen, how it could have expanded or improved by random mutation and natural selection, which is the only question that I'm focusing on in the book. You know, can these things happen by a Darwinian mechanism? And again, his work, although it's great, it doesn't even address that question. So somehow the reviewers seem to have missed that.
So you're dealing with how it originated, and Doolittle's work focused on how it worked as a process.
That's right, and how proteins of the cascade might be related to each other, or common with each other in their amino acid sequences.
Okay.
But it, you know, it's kind of like comparing two texts, you know, maybe one description of something from one encyclopedia versus a description of the same topic in a different encyclopedia, and noting that they have a lot of the same words and so on. Maybe they were written by the same guy, maybe so, but the question is, can the differences be accounted for by random mutation and natural selection? And his, Doolittle's, along with pretty much everybody else's evolutionary work, does not address that crucial question.
Okay. Well, then the reviewers misrepresent you on your claim that the evolution of chloroquine resistance in malaria by random mutations is exceedingly unlikely. Seems they missed your responses to critics and major points you make in your books about this. Can you explain a little bit?
Well, again, it's really hard to explain. Yeah. Because I say something clearly one thing, and they, you know, and these are, you know, smart guys. One's a top scientist. Two of them are also scientists, not evolutionary biologists. But they simply missed or misrepresented or couldn't understand or something what I said in my books. For example, I wrote a whole book called The Edge of Evolution in order to address the question, you know, if you're like me and I see design in nature that's beyond random processes, but there are some things that certainly can be accounted for by random processes in nature that occur in life. So where's the edge? What's the rough dividing line between what looks like it can be accounted for by just normal unguided processes plus natural selection and what requires intelligent design? And I wrote the book, The Edge of Evolution, to say that, well, in developing resistance to the drug chloroquine, the malaria parasite had to develop two coordinated mutations, just two little tiny changes in amino acid residues in one protein of its genome, and that it took it an enormous amount of time to do so. And so I developed that and says, well, it's not going to be much more than two, maybe four or so changes that would be the edge of evolution that could not be explained by randomness and selection because there aren't enough opportunities in the entire history of life. And not in this review, but one of the comments by one of the reviewers elsewhere said that in my book, I claimed that Darwinian processes could not have allowed the malarial parasite to develop resistance. And, you know, what did I say? Did I say that, you know, it was directed, that the resistance? No. You know, the guy just misread it, and it just missed the whole concept. And it's really astounding. How do you put your name on something like that? Or how do you review a book when you clearly don't even understand English sentences? Can't read with comprehension, it seems.
Yeah. And no one can read all the literature and every viewpoint ever discussed, but you do expect some level of homework being done before you review a book such as yours.
Sure.
Well, that's three. How about a fourth example of the reviewers resurrecting old arguments about your work that you've already refuted? This came when they cited a 2014 paper by Summers et al. That you had in fact publicly written about and which strongly supports your arguments. Tell us more about that one.
Yes, well, this kind of follows in what's a pattern by now, and that is that they claim that I don't engage with critics. But what is actually the case is I engage very much, and they didn't read any of my responses. What's more, they seem to confuse what I was arguing about with my example of chloroquine resistance in The Edge of Evolution. And they also seem to have misunderstood the import of the Summers et al. Paper in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences in 2014. The basic argument of The Edge of Evolution was that if malaria needed two mutations to have resistance to chloroquine, not just one, but it needed to accumulate two specific mutations, then that would require, you know, a billion times more organisms or time or opportunities than if it just needed one. And I said that the data was consistent with that being the case, that it required two. And after the book came out, every Darwinian biologist who reviewed the book poo-pooed my argument, says, oh, you know, that's not necessary. And this paper, 7 years after the book came out, undertook an enormous amount of work And what they showed was that, yes, indeed, two changes in a particular protein of the malaria parasite were indeed needed to confer upon it the ability to resist the drug chloroquine. So it exactly confirmed my prediction. It was a strong support for my argument, and the reviewers pretty much missed the whole thing.
Huh. So, yeah, something's going on there. It's funny how that, you know, the Darwinian process, when it comes to the Darwinian process, time is the best friend. But then when you put time under the microscope and say, hey, wait a minute, is there enough time to do this, this, and this? They start defending it and say, oh, of course there is, you know, or it doesn't take that long, you know.
Sure.
It's just strange how they approach that.
Yes, and other people notice things like I mentioned too. You know, these ideas are not hard. I mean, if you're, you know, the background and stuff, proposing that two mutations might be needed is pretty straightforward. And as a matter of fact, I wrote in the book that other researchers, and I cited the paper, did in fact say, well, maybe a couple mutations are needed before resistance is present in the malarial parasite to chloroquine. And when they say it, you know, nobody bats an eyelash. But when you say it in the context of asking the question, you know, are there any limits to Darwinian evolution, then the wagons are quickly circled and guns come out blazing.
Yeah, good analogy. Well, the reviewers also suggest you derided the long-term evolution experiments of one of the review's authors, Richard Lenski. Yes, that Richard Lenski, whose decades-long experiments on evolution earned him election to the National Academy of Sciences, perhaps the most highly qualified person in the world to be responding to the arguments of your book. In your response, you write, Lenski is rightly proud of his work and naturally wants to accentuate the positive. I, however, am interested in the question of whether Darwinian processes could have constructed the sophisticated machinery of life, so I consider the results from a different angle. What are they missing on this topic?
They're missing a number of things. First of all, I never deride Richard Lenski or his work. I think it's terrific. I think it's pushed the field along a whole lot further than we would be without it. The only thing I differ with him is on the interpretation of what those experiments show. Lenski has grown bacteria in his lab for 30 years now and has shown a number of mutations come along that improve the ability of the bacteria to grow and reproduce and so on in his laboratory flasks. But it's only been in the past, 5 years or so that they were able to sequence the DNA of all the improved bacteria, and they came up with a list of 30 genes that were the most highly beneficial, the 30 mutated genes that were the most highly beneficial for this bacterium, E. coli. And it turns out they all degraded or destroyed the functions of the pre-existing genes. So that is strong support for the argument of Darwin devolves, that in fact it's very easy to break a gene, and that often breaking a gene can help in specific niches and specific circumstances. That's a straw man that I don't like his results. I love his work, and I've said so on many occasions. Additionally, you were right in the introduction to this question that Richard Lenski, is the most qualified person to judge my argument in Darwin devolves. And yet, other than kind of sniffing that I hurt his feelings or that I derided the experiments, he and his co-authors say absolutely nothing about what his own experiment shows. And I think that's extraordinarily telling.
Sure. Yeah, strange and telling. Well, what's the takeaway, Mike, from this review of your new book in Science?
Well, the takeaway is this. The journal is one of the top journals in the world. The reviewers were very well qualified to judge my work, especially Richard Lenski, and they were very well motivated to show why it was wrong. All they really had to do was use their expertise and their knowledge of Darwin's theory and point out where my argument was wrong. Instead of doing that, they wrongly said that I was essentially holed up and not responding to criticisms, that previous experiments had shown I was wrong, and other things. They did not use the experiments of Richard Lenski himself to show how, in fact, I was wrong. And they didn't point to any examples to show how I was wrong. So they clearly are unhappy with the book. But again, as I said on my initial reaction, I'm extremely happy with this review, even though it is negative, because the way I see it, the most qualified people in the world who are highly motivated to discredit the idea could not lay a hand on it.
Even in the pages of one of the most prestigious science journals in America.
Even when writing for their scientific peers, the journal is read by, you know, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of scientists, and you want to put your sharpest criticisms, your best writing and everything forward in an opportunity like that. And the result that, or the effort that they put out, I think, shows that they've come up against a more difficult problem for Darwin than they had expected.
Yeah. Well, if this is a sign of things to come, I share your excitement about the impact your book's going to have, not just on the general population, but on the scientific community as well.
Yeah, this is a problem that really can't be ignored. It's easy to see, you know, the mutations. Yeah, there can be beneficial mutations, but the mutations very frequently degrade genes. Every graduate student, every assistant professor who's starting a new experiment in this area will now be saying, okay, let me show where Behe is wrong, or let me show that this isn't the case. And they, take my word for it, won't be able to do so. And so it's going to, it's unavoidable. It'll always be there. And I think it'll go a long way to changing people's viewpoints.
Well, thank you so much for your new book and for sharing these really important points about Darwinian evolution. Well, that's all the time we have, Mike. Again, thank you for coming on the show and continuing this discussion with us.
Sure. I'm always happy to do so. Look forward to coming back some other time.
Yeah, in other episodes, I think we'll take a closer look at The Arguments of Darwin Devolves, a very important book, so we can look out for those. In the meantime, learn more about Michael Behe's new book at darwindevolves.com. That's darwindevolves.com. Listen to more episodes of ID the Future at idthefuture.com or search for it on your favorite podcasting app. For ID the Future, I am Andrew McDermott. Thanks for listening. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.